From WHYY in Philadelphia, I'm Terry Gross with Fresh Air. R. Crumb was a founder of the underground comics movement of the 60s. He gave us Zap Comics, Mr. Natural, Fritz the Cat. A new documentary about him won the Grand Jury Prize for Best Documentary at the Sundance Film Festival. On today's Fresh Air, Ken Tucker reviews the film, and we meet the director, Terry Zwigoff. Zwigoff used to play with Crumb in the band R. Crumb and the Cheap Suit Serenaders. That's them we're listening to now. Then we'll talk with Bill Griffith, who also emerged from the underground comics movement. He's the creator of Zippy the Pinhead. Griffith is now chronicling Zippy's adventures in Cuba, a land cut off from the American consumer culture Zippy thrives on. And music critic Milo Miles remembers rock and roll in the days before Elvis. That's all coming up on Fresh Air. First, the news. This is Fresh Air. I'm Terry Gross. R. Crumb was one of the founders of the underground comics movement in the 60s and became the most famous of the artists. Crumb, who was always kept out of the public eye, is now the subject of a new documentary. It won the Grand Jury Prize at the Sundance Film Festival. His comics are twisted, neurotic, and sex-obsessed. And it turns out, so is R. Crumb.
When I was 13 and 14 and trying to be a normal teenager, I was like really a jerk. I mean, I tried to, act like I thought they were acting. It just came out all wrong and weird. So then I just stopped completely and just became a shadow. And I wasn't even there. No, people weren't even aware that I was, in the same world they were in. And that kind of freed me completely because I wasn't under those pressures to be normal. So I got interested in old-time music and went to the black section of town knocking on doors and looking for old records and things like that that would be unthinkable if you were going to be a normal teenager. This is my image celebrating Valentine's Day, February 13th, 1962. I decided to reject conforming when society rejected me. I've heard all that be yourself stuff. When I'm myself, people think I'm nuts. Guess I'll have to be satisfied with cats and old records. Girls are just utterly out of my reach. They won't even let me draw them. Yeah, all that changed after I got famous.
That's an excerpt of the new movie Crumb, which was directed by Terry Zwigoff. We'll meet Zwigoff in a couple of minutes. First, critic Ken Tucker has a review of the documentary.
At the start of this extraordinary documentary, we see Robert Crumb lecturing to a group of scruffy art students in Philadelphia. He shows them slides of some of his best-known images, the cover of Big Brother and the Holding Company's 1968 album Cheap Thrills, a drawing of his lewd feline character Fritz the Cat, and the cartoon that became a kind of hippie talisman, Keep on Truckin'. Crumb explains that he's showing them this stuff to jog their memories, to establish a connection with the students who might not otherwise know who he is. And then Crumb proceeds to badmouth all three of these famous works of his, heaping contempt on the pop culture industry that made those images pervasive, and expressing equal contempt for himself, for what he perceives as selling out to greedy hacks. He's even not too proud to reveal how little he made for the drawing of that famous cover of Janis Joplin's multi-million-selling album, a measly $600. What comes across in this opening scene is the cranky, contradictory public persona that Crumb has created for himself. The most famous underground cartoonist of the 60s who has always hated the counterculture. The sex-crazy weirdo who lives a calm bourgeois life with his wife and daughter. The artist who helped destroy distinctions between high art and low, but whose own aesthetics are deeply reactionary. As portrait of the artist stuff, the movie Crumb is beautifully lucid. There are sharp comments from the critic Robert Hughes that place Crumb in an art historical context. There are scenes of Crumb fondling women's backsides for a photo shoot for a porno magazine that place Crumb in a psychopathological context. And some lovely, quiet scenes of Crumb sketching in his notebook. But then the movie goes much deeper as it reveals its true intention, which is to place Robert Crumb in the context of his family. A family so profoundly troubled that the fashionable term of the moment, dysfunctional, seems pathetically superficial. Director Terry Zwigoff interviews Robert's older brother Charles and his younger brother Max. Neither of them lives in the real world. Charles, an articulate, witty man, seems to be in a perpetual state of nervous breakdown. He hasn't left his mother's house in years, reads the same 19th century philosophy text over and over, and freely admits that he really ought to bathe more often. Yet when this sweaty recluse was a boy, he was also a very talented cartoonist and the person that got Robert interested in being an artist. Max, on the other hand, is a mystic, too troubled to be blissed out. His only apparent source of income comes from begging on the street while sitting on a bed of nails. Robert seems fully aware of how odd his siblings are. He sees many aspects of himself in them. He grins and laughs very nervously as he blames it all on his late father. All three brothers believe that Dad's tyrannical bullying managed to produce these intensely repressed, introverted men. To a great extent, Robert Crumb's contempt for his audience, whom he feels have both undervalued and misunderstood him, enables this movie to be the revelation it is. Zweigoff was free to explore the profound misogyny and self-loathing in Crumb's work because the artist doesn't care what we end up thinking about him. By the end of the film, Crumb has traded three notebooks of drawings for a house in France, and this American genius who despises America is shown packing up his beloved old jazz records and his equally beloved wife and child and bidding the U.S. good riddance. Just as the intricately detailed ugliness of Robert Crumb's drawing can be tremendously moving, so does this film biography make Crumb's crabbed, obsessive life seem like a pure triumph.
Ken Tucker is Fresh Air's rock critic. He writes about popular culture for Entertainment Weekly. The director of the documentary Crumb, Terry Zweigoff, has been a friend of Crumb's for 25 years. Zweigoff says he first thought of making this film back in 1974 when he met R. Crumb's reclusive older brother Charles. R. Crumb credits Charles with getting him and the whole family interested in comics. Zweigoff looked beyond Charles' eccentricity and saw brilliance and wit. Terry Zweigoff is also the director of a documentary about blues musician Howard Armstrong called Louie Bluey, and a documentary about Hawaiian music called A Family Named Mo. I spoke with him about his new documentary, Crumb. I think what I find fascinating about your film is that it raises a lot of questions about madness and genius. I mean, both R. Crumb and his older brother Charles are not what we'd call normal. They're both incredibly talented, but it seems that Charles didn't have the energy or the will to actually work, whereas R. Crumb had the drive. In fact, he was obsessive about his work. Did you find yourself thinking a lot during the making of this movie about that combination of madness and genius?
Oh, yeah. I had read a book called Touched with Fire. Forget the woman that wrote it.
Oh, that's the book about manic depressives.
Yeah,
who were
and the
artists.
Correlation between manic depressive illness and creativity. It's a really interesting book. Ran down all these figures in history, famous artists and writers like Melville and Poe and Byron, and how they all had this incredibly high rate of either suicide or being institutionalized. And I don't know, in general, you know, I find most art, whether it's film or painting, anything that stems out of suffering by the artist is generally what I'm attracted to, you know. Like my favorite films are by, you know, people like Scorsese, who, you know, I don't know, he's probably pretty well adjusted now after all his success, but I'm sure when he started out, he's probably a very bitter, twisted guy, and he made very interesting films. He still does, to his credit, but he makes films you don't usually see in Hollywood, you know, films about losers and loners and the disenfranchised, and that's always been of interest to me.
Your film, Crumb, opens with R. Crumb on the telephone calling up his brother, saying that you want to come over and shoot some scenes there, that you want Charles in the movie.
Right.
And Charles apparently doesn't want to do it. He doesn't want to be in the film. What made him change his mind?
Well, what really happened is when I started this film about 1985, I told Robert when he finally agreed to do it that I had no interest in making it unless his brother Charles and his mother and his brother Max and agreed to be in it. And so he said, well, all right, well, let me call my mother and see if she'll do it, because she's probably going to say no. But he called her, and she remembered me, and I had actually hit it off with her pretty good, as I really liked her, and I thought the feeling was mutual when I met her, and ditto with Charles, and they both said yes at the time on the phone. So I told him to tell her that, you know, it would take me a couple months to get it ready, but in a couple months we'd come out their way with a small film crew, and I'd like to spend 4 days at their house filming them. She said, okay. We kept her posted on the dates, and then when we arrived at that motel, you see that scene in the film where he calls her and she says no. She had just completely changed her mind, and I was sort of devastated and, you know, rather shocked, but I spent the next 4 days with the crew sitting around the motel trying to convince her to change her mind back to agree to do the film, and eventually I was able to.
R. Crumb's older brother Charles committed suicide shortly after your film was completed. Do you know what happened that put him over the edge?
No, I don't. I don't know what happened at all.
Did you ever worry at all that him being exposed in the film might have upset him or anything?
I worried very much. I had a long talk with Robert about that very subject, whether this film in some way could have contributed to that happening. I don't know. I don't know what the answer is. You know, Robert's opinion was no, that he tried to kill himself a number of times. And, you know, I was worried that possibly that talking about some of these childhood family issues had sort of precipitated things. But then again, when I first met Charles in the early 70s, that's, you know, he talked about exactly the same stuff. So I don't know, it's something I have to sort of deal with for the rest of my life. If it did have anything to do with it, I would feel extremely bad.
You're obviously really absorbed in R. Crumb's family, and it's a family of very unusual people. Crumb's younger brother is into some kind of unusual approaches to meditation and so on. I mean, he lies on a bed of nails and swallows something that looks like a fabric tapeworm. His mother is very overweight and doesn't seem to even have the strength or the will to sit up on the couch. But you're not parading them as a family of freaks. You seem to just be riveted by them, by their attitude toward life, by what they have to say. What fascinates you about the family and the relationships of the people in it?
I liked his family very much. When I met them, I felt very close to them. I can't explain why. I felt a deep bond with his family. And I was a little, I've been a little horrified to see now and then in the press somebody describes the family as, you know, in a rather insensitive way, like you were referring to. And I never saw them as that, you know. I always found this very brilliant people, and yeah, a little eccentric, but I really thought they had, I thought they're incredibly interesting to talk to and incredibly funny, and you get to know these people, you find they're very interesting, very likable people.
My guest is Terry Zweigoff, director of the new documentary Crumb, about comic book artist R. Crumb. More after a break. This is Fresh Air. Back with Terry Zweigoff, director of the new documentary, Crumb. R. Crumb the cartoonist and R. Crumb the man are both sexually obsessed. How did you decide about how you wanted to deal with that in the film?
Well, it was never, you know, I tried in this film to emulate Robert in a sense, in the way he works, and that he sort of goes with his instincts and just sort of tries not to plan, you know, what direction you're going in and trust your instincts and see where that's going to get you. And sometimes you wind up in a dead end and somewhat embarrassed and make a big mistake. And sometimes it's very, very much of a, you get a great payoff out of that. And I never thought about it too much. I just tried to instinctually sort of go along and decide, where's this taking me? Where's this going? What should I, you know, go to next? And it seemed like the two things motivating his art the most and actually fueling him as an artist the most were sex and anger. And, you know, I chose some of his work to show that definitely dealt with both those issues.
You've been Crumb's friend for a long time. Has he expected you to share his sexual obsessions?
No. He's always made fun of my sexual obsessions. I don't know if I have sexual obsessions, but my sexual taste, he's always insinuated that I'm homosexual because I like skinny women, thin women. And I've always sort of told him that I always thought, since he likes muscular women, that would seem to be more indicative of that in his case. But, you know, this is beginning to sound like some episode of Seinfeld or something where, oh, there's nothing wrong in being gay, of course.
Not that there's anything wrong with that.
Yeah, not that there's anything wrong with that, but... yeah, I know we sort of joke about it. But we certainly have never, I don't think our taste has ever overlapped in what we find attractive in the opposite sex, that's for sure.
Was he ever embarrassing to be around? Did he ever do anything that was very embarrassing to you?
I was driving him somewhere in my car in San Francisco years ago, and this is the first time I really realized how sexually twisted he was and how obsessed. We're driving down the street, and he saw this woman. Well, I didn't know he saw a woman. I just noticed that he was sort of craning around in his seat and sticking his head out the window to try to see what we had just passed. And he was incredibly animated about it, just going crazy. I said, "What? What?" And I turn around, and there was this woman who was walking down the street who was, I don't know what the correct word is, but, you know, a pinhead, had a very small head.
Mm-hmm.
And he was incredibly excited over her, incredibly excited, just, you know, thought that was the most attractive thing he'd ever seen on a woman. I thought, God, that's pretty strange, pretty strange.
Did he whistle or anything?
No, he was upset for the rest of the day. He was depressed for the rest of the day because he lusted after her so much, he knew he'd never be able to meet her.
I find it very hard to interview friends because when you're interviewing somebody, you really want them to reveal things. When you're interviewing a friend, you know their strengths and weaknesses. You want to protect their weaknesses.
Yeah.
And if they tell you things that are very personal, you almost want to say, "You sure you want to say that on tape?" You know,
there are many things I left on the editing room floor in this film
to protect Crumb.
Well, to protect his family, certainly. There were a lot of things said, say by Charles, you know, or his mother, that I just thought are just nobody's business and has no relevance in this film.
It must have been hard, though, for you to figure out where that line ought to be.
People always said, "You know, how can you do that? It's such a thin line to tread." I never had a problem with that. I felt very decided one way or another immediately when something, you know, I looked at something in the editing room, whether this was appropriate or not. It always seemed very easy for me to make that choice. I don't know why. Other things were certainly a lot harder.
How did you meet Crumb?
I was involved, I had met a couple documentary filmmakers in San Francisco when I first moved there. And they were working on a documentary film about the animal abuse. I forget what it was called, actually, but they had assembled this work in progress that I was over there for dinner one night. They had the flatbed in their living room, and I said, "Oh, what are you working on?" They said, "Oh, we're working on this animal rights documentary." And I said, "Oh, really? Well, I'd like to see it." And they showed it to me. It was just horrifying. The footage was just so gruesome. I mean, I'm haunted to this day by some of the stuff I saw in there. It was a very powerful film, though, you know, and I felt somewhat radicalized politically from seeing it. And I, you know, of course, it was one of the first times that I saw, okay, gee, film is a pretty powerful medium here, huh? It's interesting. But at the same time, more specifically, I thought, I saw in the later months they were having a lot of trouble getting anybody to even come see this film when it was done. And one of the reasons was it was too unpleasant to sit through. And I had the idea to do a comic book about the same issues that would be more metaphorical. And I contacted some other cartoonists whose work I liked, like Art Spiegelman, and he actually contributed this, you know, 4-page comic strip that was called Mouse at the time. It was the entire Mouse book condensed to 4 pages, and it was a very early rendition of what he later developed and refined, and it wasn't very good. I remember looking at it thinking, the cats are Nazis, the mice are Jews. Boy, that's pretty lame, you know. And I almost didn't print it, you know, very brilliant as a publisher back then.
Wow.
But it actually wasn't too good back then, in my defense.
I'll point out for our listeners who don't know, it went on to win a Pulitzer Prize
after
it was fully formed. And it's a fantastic work.
Oh, it's a great book, yeah. And the version he turned in wasn't all that great at that time.
So Crumb did something good for
you.
Yeah,
I met Crumb and I asked him to do something for this book. And his initial response was, "Oh, you want to do a Be Kind to Animals comic, huh?" You know, a complete ridicule. But he actually warmed up to the subject, and, you know, I made him more informed about, you know, I gave him some of the literature and showed him some of this film, and he eventually warmed up to it, and he did a cover and a story to this comic, which eventually was published and called Funny Aminals Comics.
Oh.
It's a rare collector's item today, and it didn't have much to do with my original intention. These underground cartoonists were so used to this drawing whatever they wanted that, you know, they generally worked with this theme of animals, but it sure didn't have much to do with what I originally asked them to do, and it was somewhat of a disappointment to me.
Now, did Crumb's comics mean a lot to you?
I liked his work a lot. You know, I'd seen it in college and read it and always enjoyed it. I always thought he was a really great cartoonist, but it never, you know, I didn't really think he was a great artist until much later, until I got to know him. I hung out with him for a while, and he actually changed the way that I see the world.
How so?
Well, the one incident I can remember is coming home from work one day, and he had a key to my house. He was staying at my house for a week, and he had lost the key, and he was locked out. And to pass the time, he was drawing a sketch of this house across the street from me up on the corner, this house that I'd seen, 10,000 times since I'd lived there. And I looked at the sketch he did, and I looked back at the house. I never saw that same scene the same again. He had slightly exaggerated the number of overhead telephone wires and electrical junction boxes and all that junk, and that stuff had always been invisible to me. And that's all he sees in the world, He's almost like this person from another planet, He's always looking for a weakness or something critical to get at, and it's very informative hanging out with the guy. I can't say I'm a happier person from the way I feel much more aware, though, of what's going on in the world.
So what is Crumb's reaction to your movie? Do you know?
He saw it a couple of weeks ago on videotape. I asked him to wait and see it on film, but he's very insistent. And finally, I sent him a video, and he is very upset with it. I don't know exactly why. I'm going to talk with him next month. His reaction, what he said to me was, it was excruciating from start to finish. It was so embarrassing, and I had to take a walk in the woods after seeing it to clear my head. So I took my hat off, my favorite hat I've had for 20 years, and I threw it off a cliff, and I decided I don't want to be R. Crumb anymore. And I'm not quite sure what that means.
Well, that's pretty interesting.
Yeah,
You think he started to see himself as a persona after seeing himself
in the film?
I don't know.
I guess I'll find out.
It's funny, our critic who reviewed your film, Ken Tucker, said that you were free to explore the profound misogyny and self-loathing in Crumb's work because Crumb doesn't care what we end up thinking about him. Maybe he does care.
Oh, he cares. I think the main reason he had that reaction to the film is he realized that although makes a big show of being very frank and honest in his own comics, he ultimately controls what he does reveal and how it is revealed and how he presents himself. And he draws the line at certain places that I didn't, and he wasn't comfortable with that. And it's, completely understandable.
Do you think this is going to affect your friendship?
I hope not. I can't tell yet. I can't tell.
I thought I'd end our interview with a recording that you made back in the 70s, I guess.
Oh, God.
With R. Crumb and the Cheap Suit Serenaders. And this was a band led by Crumb that played early jazz and some blues and pop from mostly the 20s and 30s.
Pretty much, late 20s, early 30s. We mainly played the stuff on string instruments, though. None of us could play horns or reeds. So, like the mandolin would take a clarinet part and the steel guitar would take a trombone part, that sort of thing. Sort of a novelty band.
How'd you start playing?
I started playing because I had this interest in the music itself. I mean, my favorite music was stuff like, Bix Beiderbecke, Louis Armstrong, music of that period, Jelly Roll Morton, and I had a good collection of it on old 78s, and so did these other guys in the band, Bob Armstrong, Al Dodge, Robert Crumb, and we were all friends, and at some point we all started imitating, trying to do our own versions of this music, which was, none of us are very good musicians, but we really were sincerely fans of this stuff, so we did our best.
And you'll be playing together, you told me before.
We're going to be on the Garrison Keillor Show June 3rd.
Well, that should be fun. Hopefully you and Crumb will be talking to each other and you'll be on good terms for the reunion.
I hope so. It'll be strange if not.
Well, I want to thank you very much for talking with
us. Thank you.
Terry Zwigoff directed the new documentary, Crumb. It opens this Friday in New York and will open in cities around the country over the next few months. Zwigoff and Crumb will reunite in the band R. Crumb and the Cheap Suit Serenaders June 3rd for a live performance on A Prairie Home Companion. I'm Terry Gross, and this is Fresh Air.
Singing in the bathtub, sitting alone, tearing out a tonsil just like a baritone. It's an awful pain. Singing in the shower is like singing in the rain. Oh, there's dirt to be abolished, but don't forget one thing, while the body's washed and polished.
Major funding for Fresh Air is provided by Borders, where the love of books and music sets the standard. Additional support comes from the listeners of WHYY in Philadelphia, where Fresh Air is produced. This is NPR, National Public Radio.
From Philadelphia, I'm Terry Gross with Fresh Air. What's Zippy the Pinhead doing in Castro's Cuba, making a pilgrimage to the land that gave us the first sofa bed? Zippy is the ultimate consumer of American popular culture. His creator, comic book artist Bill Griffith, recently took a trip to Cuba because he thought it would be interesting to put Zippy in a place where American culture can't get in. Coming up, we talk with Griffith about relics of pop culture that have survived. And world music critic Myla Miles takes us back to rock and roll before Elvis. He reviews a collection of recordings by the Trenières. That's all coming up on Fresh Air. This is Fresh Air. I'm Terry Gross. Zippy the Pinhead is having a hard time getting by in Cuba. No McDonald's, no Ricky Lake, none of the American consumer culture he thrives on. Zippy is the creation of comic book artist Bill Griffith. He started drawing Zippy as an underground comic 25 years ago. Now Zippy is a syndicated strip featured in about 200 papers. There are two main characters in the strip, Zippy and Griffith's alter ego Griffy, the alienated intellectual. Zippy's adventures in Cuba are now being chronicled in Griffith's strip. You can expect to see more from Griffith about Cuba sometime soon in The New Yorker. Bill Griffith told me why he wanted to go to Cuba.
My reason for wanting to go to Cuba has a lot to do with the fact that, as far as I understand the world, Cuba is one of the few places on the planet untouched by American consumer culture. I wanted to see what that was like.
It's hard to believe, huh?
Yeah. I think it's Cuba and Burma. I think those are the only two countries that don't have a McDonald's. And I was just curious. I mean, separate from everything, every other reason that most people would want to see Cuba for, that was a big part of my reason. I wanted to scare the Zippy in me.
Did you find a lot of pop remnants of the past from the pre-revolutionary era?
Yeah, that was a fascinating part especially about Havana. Havana seems to be this very strangely decaying yet perfectly preserved museum of the past 500 years, going back to the 1500s, I guess, when it was founded. But the last century especially, there are parts of Havana that are completely frozen in the 60s, actually, which is most of Havana, since that was when the revolution happened. And then there's complete sections that are the 50s, the 40s, the 30s, the 20s, the teens. It's literally a cultural museum. It was great. I loved it.
Well, in your comics, the characters find all the remains of the gangster era have been enshrined. You know, Meyer Lansky's hotel room is still intact.
Right.
What, Al Capone's
right.
place is a restaurant now?
Al Capone's resort is... Actually, Al Capone's resort is a school, but across the street is a restaurant called Casa de Al,
which, that's great.
Which I think was one of his houses, yeah.
Uh-huh.
It was a place where he did most of his rum running, is what I was told.
The
gangster era is well-preserved and kind of revered, actually. It's a strange... I mean, Cuba, they're trying to encourage tourism, so it might be a function of that, or it might be just the general... just sort of respect for their own history, that they don't shy away from that part of their past. In fact, they talk about it with a strange mix of pride, I guess because they overcame it, obviously. They revolted against it and beat it out of their country. But the gangster era is pretty apparent all throughout Cuba. You can see evidence of it everywhere.
Did you go to Meyer Lansky's hotel room?
Yes, which you can rent for $200 a night. It looks exactly as if he just, had breakfast and, the maid just cleaned up and he left. I was given a little tour of it by the bellman. I remember one weird moment when he was, once again, the tourism that's taking root in Cuba is very sort of in an awkward stage. So the bellman was doing his best to give me a guided tour of Meyer Lansky's suite, but he was... I sensed he was exaggerating and making mistakes all the time. For instance, and I knew this was true when he pointed to a clearly faded reproduction of it of a Degas painting and told me this was an original Degas that Meyer Lansky owned. I mean, it was faded. There was no yellow or red, and it was just the blue left from being exposed to the sun for 25 years, 30 years.
You went down to Cuba to do a comic strip about a place that doesn't have American pop culture. And, you know, it's very amusing to find this absence. At the same time, you were exposed to things that are really serious and tragic. You were there during the last of the Balseros, the rafters, who were trying to get out of Cuba and make it to Florida. How did you deal with the more tragic aspects of what you saw?
Well, I tried not to avoid it, for one thing. I tried to seek it out and examine it. But it's a very poignant country. I mean, the tragedy is right on the surface. Even when you're just walking around Havana, the feeling that you're witnessing the beginning of an end game is very prevalent. You feel like within a few years, everything is going to be very different and potentially much worse. I remember I interviewed a couple of Balseros on the beach at Cojimar just as they were about to leave. I was there like 2 days before that ended. And there was a fatalism that was very disturbing in their descriptions of why they were leaving. They didn't have any great hopes. They just wanted to get out, but they had no particular feeling of that there was a future for them.
Did you feel equipped to deal with this tragedy as somebody who usually cartoons about pop culture?
Not in the slightest, no. I was constantly overwhelmed by what was happening around me. And, I mean, I would go back to my hotel room at night and just sort of quiver for an hour or two. And I found myself actually crying a few times by myself, just at the intensity of what was going on around me.
Did you talk to any cartoonists in Cuba?
Yeah, I went. There's a place where they hang out called it's a writers union building. And I met three or four of them and actually went to one of their homes and visited them for a few hours. It's a very weird thing to be a cartoonist in Cuba right now because there's basically no publishing. There's no printing, there's no paper, there's no ink. So everybody's on hold. And I couldn't help but imagine how I would be able to handle such a thing. I'm so used to, doing a strip and just having it get in the pipeline and, you know, it's printed and then the next strip is printed and it just goes on and on. In Cuba, it just doesn't happen. For this one cartoonist I met, his work hadn't been printed in 2 years. And I said, what do you do? And he says, well, I keep drawing. And I said, how do you make a living? And he said, he does caricatures of tourists in resort areas. And I said, but you're a well-known cartoonist. And he said, yeah, well, before I start the caricature, I say, I am Francisco Blanco, and I'm a successful cartoonist, and my strip has been running 30 years. And he tells the title of the strip, and he says, I just want you to know before I start your caricature, I want you to know who I am. Then he does the caricature.
It's kind of depressing.
Yeah, very depressing.
My guest is Bill Griffith, creator of the comic strip Zippy. Griffith traveled to Cuba last fall and is now drawing Zippy's adventures there. We'll be back after a break. This is Fresh Air. Bill Griffith is my guest, and he does the comic strip Zippy the Pinhead. And right now, he's doing Zippy in Cuba, and it's based on his impressions from a trip to Cuba that he took last fall. Let's do a little bit of a flashback here and talk about the early days of Zippy.
Mm-hmm.
Can you tell us how you first created Zippy the Pinhead?
Well, Zippy is actually 25 years old this year.
Wow.
The first, yeah, hard to believe, isn't it?
He's really becoming a man.
That's right. Well, people used to ask me how old is Zippy, and I would say, well, he's either 14 or 35. But I guess now I could say he's 25. Zippy started in 1970, very casually, in an underground comic book called Real Pulp. And the assignment, such as it was from the editor back in those weirdo hippie days, was to do a really weird love story. That's what he told me to do, this guy. So I thought, well, I'll do a love triangle with a, quote, normal person and two really strange people. And I picked pinheads because I'd been looking at circus sideshow posters and reading about people like that. And I just decided to make it this love triangle called I Fell for a Pinhead, But He Made a Fool Out of Me. little knowing that this was the beginning of a 25-year career.
What is a pinhead?
The word pinhead is a circus sideshow term for what is medically known as a microcephalic, which means small skull. A pinhead is a person born with, I don't exactly know which part of their brain is missing. I think it's the frontal lobes are missing. And so they have a kind of childlike personality. They tend to be very sort of happy-go-lucky and pleasant and highly verbal, very talkative, and they speak in very rapid-fire non-sequiturs. So now you know where Zippy came from.
Right. Well, how did you use all those characteristics to develop Zippy's persona?
Well, at first, Zippy was very much like a real microcephalic, several of whom I had met at that time in the early 70s. He was just a disconnected series of impulses, basically. It took a number of years for his persona to develop into something more than that. If I had kept that up, I would have gone crazy. Over the years, I changed Zippy, I think, from just a sort of dazed goofball into, a more human character and also a vehicle for satire.
Can you tell me about one of the microcephalics, one of the pinheads who you hung around with in the days that you were creating Zippy?
Well, there was one whose name was Dooley, who I met before I came to California. I met him in Connecticut. And he had a job in a plastic bag factory, and a friend of mine was a cab driver who drove him to and from work every day. So I asked my friend if I could come along for the ride one day. So I got into the cab, and we went and picked up Dooley, and he got into the back seat, and I had never seen him before in my life. And before we even were introduced, he looked at me and said very intensely, "Are you still an alcoholic?" And I took out my notebook and started taking notes, of course. And before the end of the trip, he had decided that Walter Cronkite was God, and he was explaining to me just why that was true. It was just a rapid-fire series of incredibly dizzying non-sequiturs, which left me so full of material that it's kept me going for 25 years.
Bill Griffith, your most famous phrase, which is one of Zippy's phrases, is, "Are we having fun yet?" And that has worked its way into Bartlett's quotations. Are you pleased about that?
Yes, finally I can end arguments by lifting the 25-pound Bartlett's quotations and heaving it at my opponent and saying, "Here, read this." For years and years, people have been saying, "Are we having fun yet?" and asking me if I invented it, and then sometimes being a bit skeptical because it's so much in the culture at this point. I've even seen other people literally taking credit, including Carol Burnett, of all people, who said it. She said in a 1980 movie that I said it. I think the first time I did it was in 1976 or 7, on the cover of a Zippy comic book.
How'd you come up with it?
Well, Zippy was cavorting around the pool of San Simeon, the Hearst Castle in California. He had gotten away from a tour group, and he was just flipping out and running amok through the mansion. And at one moment, he's sliding down the banister of the mansion into the pool. And as he gets towards the bottom, he looks sort of frightened and very happy, and he screams out, "Am I having fun yet?" It just seemed like the right sort of existential thought at the moment. And I meant it just the way it sounds. It's sort of two-edged, like, are we having fun yet? It's if you have to ask, I guess you aren't, or maybe you are, or, you know, are you questioning the very nature of fun, or what is fun, what is happiness, et cetera, et cetera. So it seemed like the right question to ask.
Bill Griffith, I want to thank you a lot for talking with us.
Well, thanks for having me, Terry.
Bill Griffith is the creator of the comic strip Zippy. This is Fresh Air. Robert Siegel's with us. Robert, what's coming up on All Things Considered?
Well, we'll be hearing from NPR's Mike Schuster about today's opening of the Nuclear Nonproliferation Treaty Extension Conference at the United Nations. We'll also be hearing from Mary Kay Magstad in Cambodia. This is the 20th anniversary today of the victory of the Khmer Rouge over the American-backed government of Cambodia back in 1975. And she will talk with some of the people who survived the terribly bloody government of the Khmer Rouge and what they have to say about it today. Also on today's program, Linda Wertheimer hears from the Heritage Foundation about their plan for a federal government with just 5 cabinet departments.
Thanks, Robert. That and more on All Things Considered from National Public Radio. In an attempt to counter the tiresome notion that all rock and roll began with Elvis Presley, a number of veteran musicians and oldies fans are forever pointing out that there were hordes of raucous small combos at work in the years after World War II. Now CD reissues have brought the past back in fashion as never before, and commentator Milo Miles celebrates the return of the Treniers, pre-Elvis rockers that more or less live up to their advance hype.
When you want a song to sing, one to really, really swing, this is it, this is it. And when you want a song to move, one to keep you in the groove, this is it, this is it. And when you give a party and you want the place to hop, start to play this song and watch the whole house rock. And when you want a song to blow, one to really, really go, this is it. Yes, this is it. This is it. This is it. This is it. No!
Various members of the Trenier family have been part of the Treniers over the decades, but the folks in charge are always the identical twins, Cliff and Claude. They did a performance gimmick where only one of them would appear singing a number. Then he would walk off stage at one side, while a split second later, the other twin would come on singing the song from the opposite side. That gives you some idea of their method as entertainers. But there was also acrobatics at the piano, insane hip shaking, nonstop shrieks and catcalls, all that good stuff. Old-timers who saw the Treniers often sigh that records cannot convey their excitement, and that even the group's appearance in movies like The Girl Can't Help It don't do them justice. That could be, but the best of the Treniers recordings are plenty rip-roaring affairs, as in this tribute to some pretty high-proof patent medicine.
Wanted to go out and have a ball.
What happened?
So she bought herself a couple of bottles of Haddock, Haddock.
In addition to stomping beats, the Trainers offered endless sex and comedy commentary and quite a few hot jazz licks. This was to be expected since Cliff and Claude first recorded when they were singing together in the Jimmy Lunsford Orchestra, an esteemed big band. But lest we forget, the Lunsford Orchestra was also the source of such monuments to sobriety as I'm Nuts About Screwy Music. The Trainers, as such, started out on Mercury, where they recorded a string of tight R&B songs that favored particularly loony humor. After the band switched to the OK label in 1951, they threw caution to the winds and became louder, woollier, and raunchier, at least with their 1952 smirk classic Poontang, which they explained this way.
Poontang! Poontang! Poon is a hook, Tang is a kiss. My love in each night. Now that I'm home, I go right out and get me some poontang. Tired of talking to tigers, kangaroos are singing a song to a goose. Now that I'm home on the loose, gonna get me some poontang. Now poon is a hug, I wanted a hug so badly I was blowing my tropical top. A tang is a kiss, I wanted a kiss so badly, wanna poontang, I never to stop. I don't wanna eat.
Well, as a promotional item, the band passed out cans labeled the Trainers brand extra fancy Lower Alabama Poontang from the exclusive recipe of Miss Pussy Galore. And say no more, say no more. Incidentally, the early 50s were indeed the era of tenor sax mania, and the man who did the wailing for the Trainers was Don Hill, at his most inspired during the OK years. Bits and pieces of the OK Trainers has been reissued over the years, but the first comprehensive domestic anthology has just arrived, with five previously unreleased tracks. It's called They Rock, They Roll, They Swing, and Indeed They Do. Baseball fans who long for happier days should not be without Say Hey, the Willie Mays song, which features guest vocals from Mays himself. And there's a couple of snarky slabs of Vintage Girlfriend put down in Bald Head and Uh-Oh, Get Out of the Car. But the Trainers are mostly about unrestrained celebration. It's an art, not a science, classifying loud pop in the late 40s and early 50s, deciding who's more blues, who's more rhythm and blues, and who's more rock and roll. But to me, the Trainers do belong closest to rock, and not just because they use the word so much in their titles. Their urgency, their combination of grace and craziness, and their all-out attitude warn the world to get ready for a wild ride that hasn't ended to this day.
Milo Miles is a music critic based in Cambridge, Massachusetts. He writes for The Village Voice and The New York Times. Fresh Air's interviews and reviews are produced by Naomi Person, Amy Sallet, Phyllis Myers, and Roberta Shurrock, with Nancy Updike and Barbara Bogave. Research assistance from Becky Cohen. Our interns are Sienna Chrisman and Zeb Esselstyn. Alan Tu directed the show. I'm Terry Gross.
Major funding for Fresh Air is provided by Borders, where the love of books and music sets the standard. Additional funding is provided by Living Language. Learn a new language at home or on the go with Living Language. This is NPR, National Public Radio.